Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Law, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jane Richards, and today I'm speaking with Ian Ayres and Fred Vars about their latest book, Weapon of Choice, Fighting Gun Violence While Respecting Gun Rights, published by Harvard University Press earlier this year. Now, just before we get started, I'm going to introduce our guests. Firstly, our guest Ian Ayres is a lawyer and economist. He's Deputy Dean and the William K. Townsend Professor at Yale Law School and Professor at Yale School of Management. Professor Ayres has been a columnist for Forbes magazine, a commentator on public radio's Marketplace, and a contributor to the New York Times Freakonomics blog. His research has been featured on Primetime Live, Oprah, and Good Morning America, and in Time and Vogue magazines. Ian is a co-founder of Stick.com, a website that helps you stick to your goals. In an Illinois post-conviction proceeding, Ian Ayres helped convince a court to vacate his client's death sentence. He's the author of many books, including the New York Times bestseller, Super Crunches. Today, we're speaking about Weapon of Choice, Fighting Gun Violence While Respecting Gun Rights, and it's his 12th book. His co-author is Fred Vars. Professor Vars is the Ira Drayton Pruitt Senior Professor of Law at the University of Alabama, which he joined in the summer of 2008 after practicing law for 6 years at Miller, Shackman & Beam LLP in Chicago. His practice includes all phases of civil litigation with an emphasis on legal malpractice. Fred Vars teaches property, descendants, estates, and mental health law. His research interests include a mental health and empirical analysis of law. He's a former law clerk to Judge Bruce M. Saylor on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit and Judge Joan B. Gottschall on the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Illinois. Professor Vars also served as a fellow in the Center for the Study of Corporate Law at Yale Law School. He works with numerous suicide prevention organizations and is a member of the American Bar Association Standing Committee on Gun Violence. Ian and Fred, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Now, just to get us started, can you tell me how you came to write Weapon of Choice, Fighting Gun Violence While Respecting Gun Rights? Perhaps, Fred, you could introduce
Sure.
how you came to write the book. Thank you.
Happy to do so. The basic idea of the book is actually derived from my personal experiences. I have bipolar disorder and have been, at points in my life, suicidal. And during periods in which I feel well, I want to try to protect myself against kind of dark moments and bad decisions. So that's what, kind of the core idea of the book is to allow people who may fear suicide to take the step of protecting themselves and making it impossible to purchase a gun during a moment of crisis.
Yeah, and that was really moving reading about that in the preface of the book. It was really a profound and moving opening. So I really enjoyed that, and I was really grateful that you did share your experience. Now, perhaps, Ian, you can talk a little bit more about this problem of gun violence in the US, perhaps with reference to suicide.
Sure. The most important statistic with regard to gun violence is that nearly 2 out of every 3 gun deaths is a gun suicide. And there are many types of gun control that aren't particularly well tailored to helping on this humongous problem. We lose more than 50 people a day to gun suicide. It's basically like a Las Vegas mass shooting every day in this silent epidemic of suicide. And so this central idea of the book that we can make progress on gun suicide by empowering individuals to waive their gun rights temporarily is just a way to that we can, instead of restricting choice, we can give people a new option to help protect themselves.
And I found that really interesting. One of the key themes that comes through in the book is that you propose a number of interventions, which you call choice enhancing. Can you explain a little bit more about this model of gun control? For example, how it's decentralized and how it actually expands individuals' freedom?
Sure. If I could, one simple example of this that's really dramatically been put into focus this last summer is that we can do a better job protecting people's rights to peaceful assembly. And a way to do that, to expand choice, is to let people, when they apply for a permit to have a demonstration, to check a box to say whether they would like to have that demonstration be gun-free or not. Even in states that have open carry, it might be a better way to accommodate different constitutional rights to let people who want to have a gun-free demonstration temporarily have a park that would be gun-free while they are deciding where that group is deciding to meet.
And I would just add to that idea a little bit, Ian, that the idea, you know, obviously there were tragic instances where people have lost lives when kind of armed counter protesters show up at a peaceful demonstration, Black Lives Matter or other groups. And we wouldn't be saying, look, you can never have a firearm at a demonstration. But if it's not your demonstration and they've elected this gun-free option, well, then you can't bring guns to try to intimidate people on the other side. And we've seen the tragic consequences.
That was really interesting. And you give a practical example where this has actually happened and where it has actually worked and been legislated about. So perhaps, Fred, you can tell us more about Donner's Law, how it works and, you know, how this sort of opt-in system is effective.
Sure. Well, Donner's Law is the idea, the kind of core idea we talked about just a minute ago. And what it does is it allows an individual to put their own name into the federal background check system so that they would be unable to purchase a firearm from a gun dealer. And there's an option under Donner's Law. If you want to change your mind, you can make a request and have your name removed from the database automatically, no questions asked, but there'd be a delay period. 21 days is the version that passed in Virginia. And the idea is really, you know, so many suicides are impulsive. And the research demonstrates just having a delay period and slowing down acquisition of the most lethal means commonly used to attempt suicide can save lives. And it saves lives. It doesn't just, you know, steer people to another suicide method. It really is so impulsive, and people have one idea in mind that if you take that idea away from them, you take away the gun, you can really save lives.
And I found it really interesting. You gave some examples about across different states, different variations of Donner's Law have been introduced. Can you expand a little upon this, especially in relation for people with mental health concerns, perhaps those with symptoms and those with diagnosis?
Absolutely. And I should probably back up and explain why it's called Donner's Law. Donna Nathan was a woman in New Orleans who had been struggling with bipolar disorder, depression, suicidal thinking. She had voluntarily admitted herself to psychiatric hospitals several times in the months leading up to her to her death, she was released from hospital. And because it's still legal to buy a gun unless you've been involuntarily hospitalized, she went out, purchased a gun, and used it the same day to kill herself. Her Donna, her daughter, Katrina Breeze, has been a real advocate. And in terms of, you know, the different states, so Louisiana is a state where the bill was introduced. And that's, you know, why we call it Donna's Law after Donna Nathan. But in terms of the variations, I mean, there are a few kind of key variables. You know, you want it to be easy for people to sign up, but you also want to make absolutely sure it's the individual signing themselves up and not, you know, someone doing it, and as part of a messy divorce or, you know, for some other to harass a lawful gun owner. And so that's one variable. And we've been working hard to get it, again, as secure a system as possible, but also one that people will be able to take advantage of easily.
I did find it very interesting. I mean, there are some arguments against Donna's Law. Can you explain these a little bit? And would you refute any of these?
Sure. I mean, we had in, so I mentioned Virginia. The other state that has enacted Donna's Law is Washington State. And there, the NRA objected on a couple grounds. One, they objected to the delay period. They thought, you know, there might be some emergency need for an individual to get a gun, say domestic violence or moving into a dangerous neighborhood and so forth. So that was something that we really couldn't compromise on, because the whole purpose of the law is to slow down that gun purchase. And so the real argument against the sort of strong gun rights position is it's voluntary. It really is expanding choices for people. If you're a gun owner and you want no part of it, don't sign up. And so that's one, I think, the biggest argument against Donna's Law, and the biggest argument to refute it really is the idea that, look, it's not restricting anyone's choices. It's giving people a new option.
So it really is a libertarian argument, which does come through in the book. And you did touch on this before, but can you expand a little on how exactly you would argue that Donna's Law would save lives?
Oh, absolutely. So we've done survey research looking at asking people, you know, if Donna's Law were available, would you sign up? And in one sample of psychiatric patients, we saw 46% say they would sign up. So if you consider how many people have psychiatric problems and sort of mental illness, this is tens of thousands of people who want this option to protect themselves. So that's the one kind of critical piece of data that demonstrates that Donna's Law would save lives. The other one I alluded to before, I think, is the research on waiting periods. Many states now have either an explicit waiting period to purchase a gun. So if you go into a gun store and want to buy a gun, you have to wait and come back 2 days later, 5 days later in order to pick up the gun. And so if you compare states with waiting periods like that to states that don't, where you can walk in and walk out of a gun, you know, same day very quickly, you see lower suicide rates in states that have waiting periods. So that's a finding that has been made a couple times. And you just put that together with the finding that lots of people would sign up for Donna's Law. They're essentially opting in to have a kind of personal waiting period to purchase a gun. So you put those two together, and this could save hundreds, maybe thousands of lives a year.
It does seem like a really simple and voluntary solution, but would be so effective to a really complex problem. One case example you sort of gave was in relation to veterans and its specific application to veterans. Can you just expand on this a little bit? Because I think it's really interesting.
Yeah. So we didn't know whether veterans would be more or less likely to want to sign up, and also to be more or less likely than other people to support it as a policy matter. So Ian and I did a survey, a nationally representative sample of veterans, and found many of them, I think it was around 20%, said they would want to sign up, and a majority said they supported it as a policy matter, whether or not they personally wanted to sign up. And veterans are an important group in this country because their suicide rate is, you know, really elevated. There are something like 20 veterans a day die by suicide. So if you can get veterans on board to restrict their own gun rights, you could make a real difference.
And just in terms of understanding exactly how this would work, I want to turn back to some analogies. Ian mentioned before, you know, at Black Lives Matter protests and other protest movements, people were able to opt in to and, you know, give up their gun rights for that particular time. So I'm wondering, Ian, if you can talk a little bit about some analogies that you give in the book and how this bottom-up approach and opt-in laws might work.
Sure. Well, one analogy is to Ulysses and the Sirens. This is a kind of a hand-tying solution or a pre-commitment device that has been used successfully in other areas. Several states have registries where people with gambling problems can opt out, can give up their rights to gamble at casinos. And there's been some great success in, again, helping people. No one has to give up their right to gamble, but those that that have a problem can take action to stop their future selves from doing something that will harm them.
And that makes perfect sense. So I guess in this context, so the million-dollar question is, what about the Second Amendment? Would Donna's Law and do these analogous sort of cases, do they violate the Second Amendment and the rights and freedoms in that?
So we don't think so. And again, it's the fundamental reason that these are voluntary measures. Certainly Donna's Law, again, you know, constitutional rights can be waived. Almost every constitutional right can be waived. So, you know, you plead guilty instead of insisting on your right to a jury. You know, and the Second Amendment does not mandate anyone own a gun. And when someone decides and chooses not to own a gun, that doesn't infringe on anyone else's Second Amendment rights. It's a, you know, it's self-restriction. So that's the fundamental response on the Second Amendment. But I think, Ian, you had something you wanted to say.
Well, and it's not only constitutional, but it's the fact that it's a libertarian idea has made it politically much more palatable to a wide range of people. And so since we published the book, we just are happy that New York introduced a version of Donna's Law. But it's also been introduced in Alabama and Louisiana and Tennessee. It's not just blue states, but Trump supporting red states can understand how this can help them take action against gun violence.
And I think that leads into the next part of your book in relation to you title your chapter Laboratories of Democracy. So it's, you know, sort of this idea of how it works across different states. Can you explain a little what you mean by laboratories of democracy?
Sure. The phrase comes from Justice Brandeis, who helped us understand that one part of the genius of our federal system is that the states can experiment with different kind of policies, and collectively we can learn which kinds of laws work better than other kinds of laws. And so we've been able to, in seeing now 12 different versions of Donna's Law being introduced, we've been able to see how different states have tackled the question about how to securely allow people to sign up, and how some states have said people can deregister, can rescind their choice by just waiting for 21 days. Some bills say that you need to go to a judge and prove by a preponderance of the evidence that you're not a risk to yourself or others. Some states have said that you you need to get a note from a psychiatrist to say that you're not a risk.
Yeah, and I'd add to that too. It's not a random experiment. Each iteration of Donna's Law, I think, has built on what's come before it. And we've been involved with working with state legislators and sort of modifying model legislation. We've got a version in the appendix to the book, but we're actively involved in these states. And so you see something like, I mean, the best example of how the laboratory of democracy is working well, I think, is in Washington State. The sponsor there, Jamie Pedersen, had the idea that when you're signing up, maybe you could list email addresses of people. If you later change your mind and try to get your name out of the database, an email would be automatically be sent to your friends, family, whomever you designated. It wasn't required that you designate anybody, but if you said, you know what, I want somebody to check on me before I go out and buy a gun again, I'm going to put their name, their email down. So that was just what we think is a great innovation, and just shows that kind of creativity in different states can lead to a better result in more broadly.
And it was a lot of sort of creative solutions to these problems. Can you talk perhaps about some of the key takeaways across different states, you know, as what stood out as working really well?
Sure. So I like the fact that some states have suggested that information about this new option be available at suicide hotlines and at mental health places. And Fred mentioned that this concern about that somebody who registered might need to get off the registry because of a domestic violence concern. And so that's led to the possibility of having a judicial bypass that you could apply to get off more quickly than 3 weeks if you could show a judge that you needed to get your gun rights back more quickly.
And that makes sense. So it's not a hard and fast rule forever, but there is some flexibility built into the process in order to make it actually effective and more palatable and just realistic as well, I think.
It's not all experiments work well. One thing that was frustrating to us is the Massachusetts bill had limited the people who signed up to people who were willing to, they had to attest to the fact that they had mental health illness. And we argued long and hard, but unsuccessfully with the sponsors to take out that limitation. There's no reason why you would have to label the people who register as having mental health illness. But so we don't win them all. But overall, it's been a great learning experience to see how the states have innovated.
And I would just emphasize that in addition to the Massachusetts example, in every other state we've been involved in, and certainly this is true in Washington and Virginia that have enacted it, it is strictly confidential. So you don't have to disclose a mental illness, but you also don't have to disclose you're on the list. And it's protected against Freedom of Information Act requests. It's can't be introduced in court. I mean, it's as confidential as we can make it. And I think that's really important for people, you know, who are considering signing up, to know it's a personal, private decision.
And in terms of getting it implemented in various states, I thought that your stories about lobbying were, and your lobbying strategies were very interesting. Can you talk a little bit about what worked and what didn't? Because I think it's applicable perhaps not just for donors' law and comparative legislation, but also perhaps for other citizens' concerns.
Yeah, so in terms of what's been most effective, I guess there are probably two or maybe three big takeaways. The first is to find the right sponsor, and that's absolutely essential. And we were lucky to have personal relationships with some state legislators, and that led to a kind of credibility and a kind of immediate, that maybe that's a good idea. Because if you're a state legislator, you get pitched, I think, a lot of ideas. And it's very hard to know which are, you know, really have some substance behind them and which are kind of pet projects of a particular constituent or what have you. So having personal relationships turned out to generate sponsors. And when we got sponsors, motivated sponsors. And that was a key to success in both Virginia and Washington. Where we ran into some problems, I think this is kind of big takeaway number two, getting state legislatures to spend money on anything, I think, is a real challenge. It's not enough to have a good idea. You've got to really persuade them it's going to be cost-benefit justified, and they can explain to someone else why their budget is being diminished. And so the particular issue where this came up was trying to make it as easy as possible for people to sign up. Some states got estimates of the cost of maintaining a website for the purpose of registration that were pretty high. I mean, not high in terms of the number of lives you could save, but enough, I think, to provide some sticker shock. And that was our experience in California, actually. Where it turned out that the price estimate was just not considered feasible.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And it's interesting because what I liked about your book is not just the reform proposals, but it is so practical. So you do talk a lot about what works and the limitations, and then in doing so, you know, there's solutions as to how to overcome those limitations. So I found it really interesting. Just picking up on one of the points you mentioned earlier and related to this point of the website, you know, you've got this chapter about emails and the associational marketplace. And here you propose a really interesting idea that individuals can choose to waive their gun rights and they can communicate this choice to others via email. Now, can you just explain why this would be effective and, you know, what this would allow for?
Sure. Well, we can think about two different ways the emails might be used. One is on the back end, which Fred mentioned. If you sign up and you give, for example, your psychiatrist's email, and then you later on say, no, I want to get my gun rights back, a back end notification would the registry could send an email to the psychiatrist and say, hey, this person's trying to get his gun rights back. And the psychiatrist would have 3 weeks to check in and see, are you going hunting or are you feeling suicidal? It could really help friends and family and healthcare workers check in to make sure somebody's safe before they get their gun rights back. But the other and more controversial way to use an email notification is at the time that somebody registers. And so it's this an associational marketplace. Another way that we want to expand choice is to people have a constitutional right to associate with people that they want to. Well, we can strengthen those associational rights by making them more informed. And so you might Jane have a right to carry a gun, but I could say I don't want to have my kids over to your house for a play date if you have guns. And so I might say I only want to let my kids associate over at with you if you can show me that you've registered to give up your gun rights. And now what one person's informed associations is another person's discrimination. And so we try to balance these concerns by having it just letting people who have plausible self-defense interests in being the people that can act on the basis of such a registration. So your neighbors, your condo association would be able to say, look, you can't become part of our residential community unless we get an email showing that you have waived your gun rights.
And so in this sense, then, how would your model and this associational marketplace be more libertarian and enhance individual rights?
Sure, because it's making the Second Amendment rights contend in an associational marketplace with other people's associational preferences. And this isn't to say which will win, but you can say, no, you will only associate with me if you can keep your gun rights. And I can say, no, I'll only associate with you if you give them up and something's got to give. Trying to improve the quality of informed association doesn't mean that you'll get all your preferences, but it just allows you to have a better shot. Another way to think about this is really just to level the evidentiary playing field. If I am a condo association and I want to instead demand that all residents have guns, that's pretty easy to verify. Just show me your gun and I know you have one. But it's harder right now to prove that you don't have a gun. And this is making that easier so that if people have preferences for a gun-free zone, they can have a better shot of proving that.
Yeah, and I think that's right. It's very difficult to prove something in the negative. And so this sort of it gives possibility to that in relation to, you know, associational marketplaces.
And if you Google it about landlords and gun deaths, it's dangerous as a landlord to try to collect late rent from tenants that are armed. And so a landlord has a pretty strong, a plausible self-defense rationale for not wanting tenants that are armed. So that would be a place where this associational marketplace might improve the equilibrium.
And so I guess then it's now a good time to talk about the self-defense limitation, the self-defense discrimination limitation. Can you explain a little bit of how this works?
Sure. Well, For example, we would not allow an employer to say you can't work for me unless you give up your gun rights. Even though people sometimes disgruntled employees, the phrase "going postal" is about disgruntled postal employees shooting at their places of employment. But that's in an abundance of caution. We just want to limit it to a small set of economic actors. The most controversial thing that we'd say is that insurers that are insuring people's life and people's property, they might be able to say, no, we'll give you a better insurance rate if you can prove to us that you don't, that you're not armed. So not employers, not economic actors, unless they have their own life or their property at stake.
And so then, do you see any limits on libertarian contracting in this context?
So there are, the limits are that only economic actors that have a plausible self-defense interest are able to discriminate on the basis of registration. But let me say, quickly, this is one of the this is the most controversial part of the book, that trying to weigh associational rights with gun rights, and it is a proposal that that is not necessary for listeners to go along with. Our 10 proposals are quite modular, and you can pick some to support and not others. And that's, they don't all depend, rise or fall together.
And I think that was really interesting, the way that it could practically apply in that sense. So I guess one sort of example where this plays out is in the section where you write about privatizing gun-free zones. Correct me if I'm wrong, please, but so can you describe what privatized gun-free zones are and provide examples where this has worked?
Sure. In my hometown of Kansas City, there is an entertainment district just next door called Westport. And in 2017, they were having a problem that there was some gun violence that was the businesses were really concerned because it was scaring off their customers. And it was a kind of it's seemingly intractable problem because Missouri is a open carry state, and it's very clear that citizens have a right to openly carry weapons on the on public streets. And the innovation was that the businesses convinced the city council to sell the streets to the businesses. And once it became private property, the businesses were able to make those now private streets gun-free zones. And they actually hired the same security company that provides security for Disney to set up some metal detectors at the ends of this two-block entertainment district, and they could stop people with guns from coming in to this restaurant and bar area.
And was it effective, do you think, at reducing gun violence?
Well, it seems to have been, and as important to the businesses, it brought back a lot of their consumer business. But the bigger idea of this part of the book is that we can do a better job protecting property rights. And it's another way to see the libertarian approach is that, Jane, you have a right to bear arms, but not on my property if I don't want you to. And so we can respect your right to bear arms up to the border of my property and give me better control over who comes onto my property with guns. A lot of people that are listening would be surprised that if you have a if the dishwasher breaks in your house and you ask a repair person to come in and fix it, that person in every state can carry a concealed weapon into your home without your permission. It's just bizarre. And you have to affirmatively object to stop them from doing it. And a very simple thing we could do, which has been done in other kinds of contexts, is we can just flip the presumption. Say, look, you can't come into somebody else's home with a gun unless they give you explicit permission. Again, the gun owner can still have people with guns into the house. Just say that, invite them to bring them in. Just we have the wrong presumption here. And so we can do a better job of protecting property rights to help to give people control over whether others bring guns into their homes.
And just extending on this, this idea of protecting property rights, another really interesting and perhaps also controversial idea was your suggestion as to building in gun prohibitions on the transfer of property. This, I mean, it did seem to me to be quite radical. So can you expand a bit on how this would work?
Well, I think you're referring to like using a covenant that runs.
Yes.
Exactly. So there's nothing radical about having a covenant affecting use. I mean, whole homeowners associations are built upon, you know, restrictive covenants about paint color on your house, or how, you know, you got to keep your fence and your lawn mowed, and you can't have any political signs in your yard. So really the idea of using a covenant to affect, you know, whether or not guns can be present on a particular piece of property, you're right. It's an innovative use, I think, of a covenant. It's not unprecedented, and it's not, I would argue, different than other sort of use restrictions that are routinely upheld. But it's important to have a covenant or other restriction that runs with the land if you actually want to have a gun-free condo association. If you don't have it in the covenants, the next person who buys won't be bound by any agreement the prior owners may have had. So using a covenant that runs with the land is really essential to maintain a gun-free community.
And it's really interesting. That's one thing that kept coming through in the book, this sort of innovative use of, you know, things that already exist. And so I really appreciated that sort of creative approach in this libertarian bottom-up sort of way. I wanted to ask now, Fred, I want to talk to you about symptom-based gun removal orders. For example, you write about how tying gun removal orders to symptoms as opposed to mental health diagnosis, and this would be a bit innovative, but can you explain this a bit?
Sure, I can. And it actually shares the same or nearly the same backstory as Donna's Law. I mentioned I have bipolar disorder. I've also experienced psychosis and came out of that experience knowing access to a firearm during such a period would be an incredibly bad and dangerous idea. But to step back to the symptom-based, what's different and sort of innovative about it, the current gun laws on mental health, when we were talking about Donna Nathan, her story, so she had been voluntarily admitted to hospital. If you are involuntarily admitted, which means you have a diagnosis and you've been found at that moment to be dangerous, you lose your right to have a gun. So it's basically diagnosis-based gun control. And, you know, as a person with bipolar disorder, there are periods when I'd be perfectly safe. And there are other periods when I wouldn't be. So to have the gun restriction actually tied to the symptoms that create the danger, as opposed to a stereotype about people with a mental illness are all dangerous, to me is first just better policy. It's targeting the right problem. And two, it's avoiding stigmatization of people who aren't dangerous, or at least aren't dangerous most of the time.
Yeah, and I think what also came through in the book is you sort of argue that tying gun removal to diagnosis creates a gap. So, for example, people who haven't been diagnosed may fall through those holes, but they may display symptoms, and we're trying to reduce the stigma. So can you talk a little bit how current restrictions do miss the mark? Perhaps expand on this.
Yeah, no, I thought, I mean, you made a great point right there. Lots of people, I don't know exact percentage, but it may be nearly half of people with mental illness are not receiving treatment and may not be diagnosed. But a police officer who encounters them on the street and can see that they're obviously suffering from paranoid delusions ought to be empowered to, you know, go to a court and say, look, we see the symptoms that are creating a real danger. We want to take away their right to have a gun. We want to take away the guns they have, but we also want to make sure their name is in the background check system so they can't turn around and buy a gun, which is exactly what happened with Aaron Alexis, the Navy Yard shooter. So this was several years ago, but an individual who's experiencing paranoid delusions encountered police officers, and they wrote up a report, decided it wasn't an immediate danger, and so they didn't civilly commit or involuntarily hospitalize Mr. Alexis. He went just a few weeks later, purchased a shotgun, and then used it in a mass shooting at the Navy Yard in Washington, D.C. And so that's a great example of somebody who didn't have a diagnosis, hadn't been involuntarily hospitalized, but presented a sort of obvious danger. And the law should target that.
And I think it also reduces this link between, or this presumption of dangerousness being linked to mental health necessarily on every occasion. So can you just talk a little bit more about whether there's arguments against the symptom-based gun removal ideas?
Yeah. So I think the most compelling argument is that there are a lot of people suffering from delusions and hallucinations, even paranoid delusions, that won't actually hurt anyone with a gun. And so a mass shooting is a really rare event. It's horrible, but it is rare. And so what you're doing with a symptom-based approach, I actually think it's more narrowly tailored than, say, a diagnosis-based approach, but it's arguably not as narrowly tailored as what are called red flag laws that already exist in about 20 jurisdictions that are teed directly on a discretionary judgment of dangerousness, and that's what leads to the removal of gun rights. What we're really arguing for is expanding red flag laws to have a basically automatic disqualifier for people suffering from paranoid delusions or threatening hallucinations. And again, the big argument against is that in doing so, we're taking gun rights away from a lot of people who wouldn't actually hurt themselves or hurt anyone else. My response to that criticism is to say, look, anybody suffering from psychosis and these particularly dangerous symptoms shouldn't have a gun. And yes, it may be unlikely that they're going to hurt someone with it, but some of them will. And it's a good idea to try to avoid that.
Thank you. And now, Ian, I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about this idea of unlawful possession petitions. You present this, it seems also very interesting and creative. and a very effective idea at reducing gun deaths. So can you explain what unlawful positions are and how they'd work, and what do you see as the key impediments to the implementation?
Sure. A big problem there are more than 1 million Americans currently are in illegal possession of firearms. And gun rights advocates often say we should do a better job enforcing current restrictions before we add on new ones. Well, this unlawful possession petition is a way of trying to do a better job of enforcing existing restrictions. It may be easier for us politically to agree, well, can we at least try to disarm people who illegally possess firearms? And so the simple idea is that citizens who have knowledge about someone else who illegally owns a firearm would have an ability to come forward and file a petition for a gun removal order. And if the police then go and find a gun, they can remove it. And the person who has lost that gun could then contest that and would have a chance to go to court and prove that they were in lawful possession of it. And we suggest also that we might combine this new choice, this new opportunity to file this by giving people a small financial incentive. Many people have heard of gun buyback programs, but there have been more than a dozen cities that have had some success using gun bounty programs. And this is where you pay $500, $1,000 to someone who can come forward with evidence about someone else who is in illegal possession of a firearm, so that we can actually do a small financial incentives might really help us vacuum up some of these illegally possessed firearms.
And just picking up on this point a little bit more, there are already gun registries who include on their list who can and can't purchase guns. Why aren't they working, and how would your model improve this?
Sure. One of the big reasons they're not working is that we basically have an honor system in many states that if you, for example, if you're convicted of a felony, you no longer can lawfully possess a firearm. That's been a part of federal law for decades. But in many states, if you are convicted of a state felony, no one comes by your house and tries to collect your weapons. The honor system is that the felon is supposed to voluntarily give up their weapons to the state. And this often doesn't happen. A chilling example of this last year, a woman went to the Lakeland police and said her ex-husband, she was worried that her ex-husband was going to kill her with a weapon. And her ex-husband couldn't legally possess a weapon because he was in jail for having attempted to run her over with a car. And she had done everything she should have done. She got a protective order against the husband. But she was worried that when he got out of jail, he was going to take he had one of his guns and shoot her. And the Lakeland police, they said, oh, there's nothing they could do. And she went over to his house and took his guns and took them immediately to the Lakeland police. And they turned around and arrested her for armed burglary, because when she left, she was armed. We should do better by in contexts like this and let the ex-wife petition to have guns removed. Confiscated from her ex-husband who didn't have a right to have the guns in the first place.
Yeah, it really is quite terrifying. The outcomes are really surprising and shocking. And I think this relates to the next part of the book in relation to, you put this argument forward of incentivizing disclosure. So you write about how disclosure of unlawful weapons by others might be incentivized. So it might work in these kind of cases. So can you talk about the carrots and sticks that might work for individuals to be put in place that would make this effective?
Yeah, well, and I mentioned this idea of gun bounties, that we've had Crime Stopper incentives in other contexts. Here, it's basically applying the Crime Stoppers reward system to illegal guns. And the cities that have done this, which include Tampa and Philadelphia and a place where I lived for a year, Urbana, Illinois, they've had great success, not just in confiscating illegally possessed firearms, but a kind of surprise for me is when they do these raids, they often come up with other contraband, including large amounts, they've confiscated large amounts of illegal drugs and cash, so that the programs end up more than paying for themselves.
And that's really interesting. So it's effective not just in terms of gun control and disarming people who possess weapons illegally, but also in relation to policing other crimes, which, you know, seems to have a positive net benefit. Can you then just talk about, in relation to institutions, what carrots and sticks might work in relation in this sort of incentivizing disclosure scheme?
Sure. Well, you know, stepping back, the one of our big ideas is that government isn't always the best place to figure out who should who shouldn't have weapons. Sometimes it's the person themselves. That's why we have Donna's Law. Sometimes it's going to be the neighbors who might know that you unlawfully possess a gun. But sometimes it's going to be institutions and that. For example, Fred and I both teach at universities, and they often have learned that one of their students is having a very hard time and is acting erratically. And the institutions will sometimes ban students from campus. But few universities at that moment go forward to the police and try to bring a red flag petition or notify the police. And so one of the places where mild sticks might be used is that schools, universities, major employers, we might require that if they have information that someone is under the symptom-based approach, is showing signs of paranoid delusions or threatening hallucinations, that they should have an obligation of reporting that to the police or face some fines.
Yeah, and I mean, it seems to make sense. You know, I'm not from the US, and so the idea of, you know, being on a university campus when someone's displaying erratic symptoms and they might be able to bring a gun is, I mean, it's terrifying. So, you know, this all sort of does work together. Just bringing these points together, do you both have any key recommendations for reducing gun violence? I know that's a big question, but just, yeah, drawing the points of your book together. Perhaps, Fred, you could go first.
Sure. Well, what I would call the central and kind of core idea of the book is Donna's Law. And I think contacting your state and also your federal legislator and insisting that they consider the passing the bill, I think that's the single. I think it's the single proposal that could make a big impact and has the greatest chance of being enacted. I mean, we've already seen bipartisan support in Washington. It passed unanimously in one chamber in Utah. Ian mentioned introduction in Tennessee, Alabama, Louisiana. I mean, this is a law that I think can pass anywhere and that could make a real difference.
Thank you. And Ian, do you want to add anything?
No, that would be my recommendation as well. That, again, 2 out of every 3 gun deaths is a suicide. And focusing our reform efforts on trying to reduce that number should be just a dominant issue for us.
Thank you. So now, Ian and Fred, I've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go today, can I ask what you're both working on now? Perhaps, Ian, you can go first, please.
Sure. I am working on a new book about the power of resisted temptation.
That sounds interesting. Sorry, go on.
So it turns out that people who, for example, are offered money to quit the gym, they end up going to the gym more often. That having resisted the temptation, they find it easier to stay on track.
That sounds fascinating. Hopefully, once you're done, we can have you back on the show. We can talk more about it. Cool. And Fred, what are you working on now?
So I'm not working on a book. I'm working on my mental health scholarship and an article on the insanity defense and impact on inheritance. You mentioned I teach trust and estates as well. So kind of a niche idea, but that's what I'm working on.
No, to me, that sounds really interesting because my doctoral research is on the insanity defense. So perhaps I'll talk more to you about it later.
Sure.
Fred Vaz and Ian Ayres, thank you so much for your time today. Once again, I've been talking to Ian Ayres and Fred Vaz about their latest book, Weapon of Choice, Fighting Gun Violence While Respecting Gun Rights. I'm Jane Richards. You've been listening to the New Books in Law, a channel on the New Books Network.